until we could return for good. I knew we would have to leave, yet surrounded by the peaceful house and grounds of Lallybroch and the cheerful company of Jenny, Ian and small Jamie, I felt as though I had come home at last. After breakfast one morning, Jamie rose from the table, announcing that he thought he would go as far as the head of the valley to see a horse that Martin Mack had for sale. Jenny turned from the sideboard, brows drawn together. "Do you think it's safe, Jamie? There's been English patrols all through the district the last month or so." He shrugged, taking his coat from the chair where he had laid it. "I'll be careful." "Oh, Jamie," said Ian, coming in with an armful of firewood for the hearth. "I meant to ask, can you gang up to the mill this morning? Jock was up yestere'en to say something's gone amiss wi' the wheel. I had a quick look, but he and I together couldna shift it. I think there's a bit of rubbish stuck in the works outside, but it's well under the water." He stamped his wooden leg lightly, smiling at me. "I can still walk, thank God, and ride as well, but I canna swim. I just thrash about and gang in circles like a doodlebug." Jamie laid the coat back on the chair with a smile at his brother-in-law's description. "None so bad, Ian, if it keeps you from having to spend the morning in a freezing mill pond. Aye, I'll go."
He turned to me.
"Care to walk up with me, Sassenach? It's a fine morning, and you can bring your wee basket." He cocked an ironic eye at the enormous withy basket I used for gathering. "I'll go and change my sack. Be with you in a moment."
He headed for the staircase and bounded athletically up the steps, three at a time. Ian and I exchanged smiles. If there was any regret that such feats were now beyond him, it was hidden beneath his pleasure in seeing Jamie's exuberance.
"It's good to have him back," he said.
"I only wish we could stay," I said with regret. The soft brown eyes filled with alarm.
"You'll no be going at once, surely?"
I shook my head. "No, not at once, but we'll need to leave well before the snow comes." Jamie had decided that our best course was to go to Bewley, seat of Clan Fraser. Perhaps his grandfather, Lord Lovett, could be of help. If not, he might at least arrange us passage to France.
Ian nodded, reassured. "Ooh, aye, but you've a few weeks yet."
It was a beautiful, bright autumn day, with air like cider, and a sky so blue you could drown in it. We walked slowly, so that I could keep an eye out for late-blooming eglantine and teaselheads, chatting casually.
"It's quarter day next week," Jamie remarked. "Will your new gown be ready, then?"
"I expect so. Why, is it an occasion?" He smiled down at me, taking the basket, while I stooped to pull up a stalk of tansy.
"Oh, in a way. Nothing like Colum's great affairs, to be sure. But all the Lallybroch tenants will come to pay their rents, and their respects to the new Lady Lallybroch."
"I expect they'll be surprised you've married an Englishwoman."
"I reckon there are a few fathers who might be disappointed at that. I'd courted a lass or two hereabouts before I got arrested and taken to Fort William."
"Sorry you didn't wed a local girl?"
I asked coquettishly. "If you think I'm going to say yes, and you standing there holding a pruning knife," he remarked, "you've less opinion of my good sense than I thought."
I dropped the pruning knife, which I'd taken to dig with, stretched my arms out, and stood waiting. When he released me at last, I stooped to pick up the knife again, saying teasingly, "I always wondered how it was you stayed a virgin so long. Are the girls in Lallybroch Hall plain, then?"
"No," he said, squinting up into the morning sun. "It was mostly my father was responsible for that. We'd stroll over the fields in the evening sometimes, he and I, and talk about things. And once I got old enough for such a thing to be a possibility, he told me that a man must be responsible for any seed he sows, for it's his duty to take care of a woman and protect her. And if I wasn't prepared to do that, then I'd no right to burden a woman with the consequences of my own actions."
He glanced behind us, toward the house, and toward the small family graveyard near the foot of the broch where his parents were buried. He said, the greatest thing in a man's life is to lie with a woman he loves, he said softly. He smiled at me, eyes blue as the sky overhead. He was right. I touched his face lightly, tracing the broad sweep downward from cheek to jaw. Rather hard on you, though, if he expected you to wait so long to marry, I said. Jamie grinned, kilt flapping round his knees in the brisk autumn breeze. Well, the church does teach that self-abuse is a sin, but my father said he thought that if it came to a choice between abusing yourself or some poor woman, a decent man might choose to make the sacrifice. When I stopped laughing, I shook my head and said, No, no, I won't ask. You did stay a virgin, though. Strictly by the grace of God and my father, Sassenach. I didn't think I thought much about anything but the lasses once I turned 14 or so. But that was when I was sent to foster with Dougal at Benacht.
No girls there? I asked.
I thought Dougal had daughters. Aye, he has. Four. The two younger ones had no much to look at, but the eldest was a very handsome lassie. A year or two older than me, Molly was. And not much flattered by my attention, I dinna think. I used to stare at her across the supper table, and she'd look down her nose at me and ask did I have the catarrh, because if so, I should go to bed, and if not, she would be much obliged if I'd close my mouth, as she didna care to look at my tonsils while she was eating.
I begin to see how you stayed a virgin, I said, hiking my skirts to climb a stile.
But they can't all have been like that.
No, he said reflectively, giving me a hand over the stile. No, they weren't.
Molly's younger sister, Tabitha, was a bit friendlier.
He smiled reminiscently.
Tibby was the first girl I kissed. Or perhaps I should say the first girl who kissed me. I was carrying two pails of milk for her from the barn to the dairy, plotting all the way how I'd get her behind the door where there wasn't a room to get away and kiss her there. But my hands were full, and she had to open the door for me to go through. So it was me ended up behind the door, and Tib, who walked up to me, took me by both ears and kissed me.
Spilled the milk, too, he added. Sounds a memorable first experience, I said, laughing.
I doubt I was her first, he said, grinning. She knew a lot more about it than I did. But we didn't get much practice. A day or two later, her mother caught us in the pantry. She didn't do more than give me a sharpish look and tell Tibby to go and set the table for dinner, but she must have told Dougal about it.
If Dougal Mackenzie had been quick to resent an insult to his sister's honour, I could only imagine what he might have done in defence of his daughters.
I shudder to think, I said, grinning. So do I, said Jamie, shuddering.
He shot me a sidelong glance, looking shy.
You know that young men in the morning, sometimes they wake up with... Well, with...
He was blushing.
Yes, I know, I said. So do old men of 23. You think I don't notice?
You've brought it to my attention often enough. Mm-hmm. Well, the morning after Tib's mother caught us, I woke up just at dawn. I'd been dreaming about her. Tib, I mean, not her mother. And I wasn't surprised to feel a hand on my cock. What was surprising was that it wasn't mine.
Surely it wasn't Tibby's.
Well, no, it wasn't. It was her father's.
Dougal! Whatever!
Well, I opened my eyes wide and he smiled down at me, very pleasant. And then he sat on the bed and we had a nice little chat, uncle and nephew, foster father to foster son. He said how much he was enjoying my being there, him not having a son of his own and all that. And how his family was all so fond of me, and all that. And how he would hate to think that there might be any advantage taken of such fine, innocent feelings as his daughters might have toward me. But how, of course, he was so pleased that he could trust me as he would his own son. And all the time he was talking, and me lying there, he had his one hand on his dirk, and the other resting on my fine young balls. So I said, yes, uncle, and no, uncle. And when he left, I rolled myself up in the quilt and dreamed about pigs. And I didn't kiss a girl again until I was 16 and went to Leoch.
He looked over at me, smiling. His hair was laced back with a leather thong, but the shorter ends were sticking up at the crown as usual,
glimmering red and gold in the brisk, clear air. His skin had darkened to a golden bronze during our journey from Leoch and Craignadun, and he looked like an autumn leaf, swirling joyfully wind-borne. "And what of you, my bonny Sassenach?" he asked, grinning. "Did ye have the wee laddies panting at your heels, or were ye shy and meanly?" "A bit less than you," I said circumspectly. "I was 8." "Jezebel! Who was the lucky lad?"
"The dragoman's son. That was in Egypt.
He was 9. "Oh, well, you're no to blame, then. Led astray by an older man, and a bloody heathen, no less."
The mill came into sight below, picture pretty, with a deep red vine glowing up the side of the yellow plaster wall, and shutters standing open to the daylight, tidy in spite of the worn green paint. The water gushed happily down the sluice under the idle water-wheel into the mill-pond. There were even ducks on the pond. Teal and Goldeneye paused for a rest on their southern flight.
"Look," I said, pausing at the top of the hill, putting a hand on Jamie's arm to stop him. "Isn't it lovely?"
"Be a sight more lovely if the water wheel were turning," he said practically.
Then he glanced down at me and smiled.
"Aye, Sassenach, it's a bonny place. I used to swim here when I was a lad. There's a wide pool round the bend of the stream."
A little further down the hill, the pool became visible through the screen of willows. So did the boys. There were 4 of them, sporting and splashing and yelling, all naked as jays.
"Brr,"
I said, watching them. The weather was fine for autumn, but there was enough of a nip in the air to make me glad of the shawl I'd brought. Makes my blood run cold just to see them.
"Oh," Jamie said. "Well, let me warm it for you then."
With a glance down at the boys in the stream, he stepped back into the shade of a big horse chestnut tree. He put his hands about my waist and drew me into the shadow after him.
"You warna the first lass I kissed," he said softly, "but I swear you'll be the last."
And he bent his head to my upturned face. Once the miller had emerged from his lair and hasty introductions were made, I retired to the bank of the mill pond while Jamie spent several minutes listening to an explanation of the problem. As the miller went back into the mill-house to try turning the stone from within, Jamie stood a moment, staring into the dark, weedy depths of the mill-pond. Finally, with a shrug of resignation, he began to strip off his clothes.
"No help for it," he remarked to me. "Ian's right. There's something stuck in the wheel under the sluice. I'll have to go down and..."
Stopped by my gasp, he turned around to where I sat on the bank with my blanket.
"And what's amiss with you?" he demanded. "Have you no seen a man in his drawers before?"
Not like that," I managed to get out between sputters. Anticipating possible submergence, he had donned beneath his kilt a short garment of incredible elderliness, originally of red flannel, now patched with a dazzling array of colours and textures. Obviously this pair of drawers had originally belonged to someone who measured several inches more around the middle than Jamie. They hung precariously from his hip bones, the folds drooping in V's over his flat belly.
"Your grandfather's," I guessed, making a highly unsuccessful effort to suppress my giggling. "Or your grandmother's?"
"My father's," he said coldly, looking down his nose at me. "You don't expect me to be swimming bare as an egg before my wife and my tenants, do you?"
With considerable dignity, he gathered the excess material up in one hand and waded into the mill pond. Treading water near the wheel, he took his bearings, then with a deep breath, upended and submerged, my last sight of him the ballooning bottom of the red flannel drawers. The miller, leaning out of the mill-house window, shouted encouragement and directions whenever the sleek wet head broke the surface for air. The edge of the pond bank was thick with water plants, and I foraged with my digging stick for mallow root and the small, fine-leaved dropwort. I had half the basket filled when I heard a polite cough behind me. She was a very old lady indeed, or at least she looked it. She leaned on a hawthorn stick, enveloped in garments she must have worn 20 years before,
now much too voluminous for the shrunken frame inside them.
"Good morning to you," she said,
nodding her head like a bobbin. She wore a starched white kerch that hid most of her hair, but a few wisps of iron grey peeked out beside cheeks like withered apples.
"Good morning," I said, and started to scramble up. But she advanced a few steps and sank down beside me with surprising grace. I hoped she could get up again.
I started, but had barely opened my mouth when she interrupted.
"You'll be the new lady, of course. I'm Mrs. McNab. Granny McNab, they call me. Along o' my daughters-in-law, all being Mrs. McNabs as weel."
She reached out a skinny hand and pulled my basket toward her, peering into it.
"Mallow root. Ah, that's good for cough. But you didn't want to use that one, lassie."
She poked at a small brownish tuber.
"Looks like lily root, but it isn't that."
"What is it?" I asked.
"Adder's tongue. Eat that one, lassie, and you'll be rolling round your room with your heels behind your head."
She plucked the tuber from the basket and threw it into the pond with a splash. She pulled the basket onto her lap and poured expertly through the remaining plants, while I watched with a mixture of amusement and irritation. At last, satisfied, she handed it back.
"Weel, you're none so foolish for Sassenach lass," she remarked. "You ken Bethany from lamb's quarters, at least."
She cast a glance toward the pond, where Jamie's head appeared briefly, sleek as a seal, before disappearing once again beneath the millhouse.
"I see his lairdship didn't awed ye for your fee saloon."
"Thank you," I said, choosing to construe this as a compliment. The old lady's eyes, sharp as needles, were fastened on my midsection.
"Not wee child yet," she demanded. "Raspberry leaves, that's the thing. Steep a handful wee rose hips and drink it when the moon's waxing from the quarter to the full. Then when it weans from the full to the half, take a bit of barberry to purge your womb."
"Oh," I said, "well,
I'd a bit of a favour to ask his lairdship," the old lady went on. "But as I see he's a bit occupied at present, I'll tell you about it."
"All right," I agreed weakly, not seeing how I could stop her anyway.
"It's my grandson," she said,
fixing me with small grey eyes the size and shininess of marbles.
"My grandson, Rabbi, that is. I've 16 altogether, and the three of them named Robert, but the one's Bob, and t'other Rob, and the wee one's Rabbi."
"Congratulations," I said politely.
"I want his lairdship to take the lad on as stable lad," she went on.
"Well, I can't say..."
"It's his father, ye ken," she said,
leaning forward confidentially.
"Not as I'll say there's aught wrong wi' a bit of firmness. Spare the rod and spoil the child, I've said often enough, and the good Lord kins well enough that boys weren't meant to be smacked, or he'd not have filled them sae fu' o' the devil. But when it comes to laying a child out on the hearth and a bruise on his face the size of my hand, and for not more than taking an extra bannock from the platter, then..."
"Rabbi's father beats him, you mean?" I interrupted. The old lady nodded, pleased with my ready intelligence.
"To be sure. Is that no what I've been seeing?"
She held up a hand.
"Now, in the regular way, of course, I'd not interfere. A man's son's his ain to do as he sees fit, but, weel, Rabbi's a bit of a favourite o' mine, and it's no the lad's fault as his father's a drunken sot, shameful as 'tis for his own mother to say such a thing."
She raised an admonitory finger like a stick.
"Not but what Ronald's father didn't take a drop too much from time to time. But lay a hand on me or the bairns he never did. Not after the first time, at any rate," she added thoughtfully.
She twinkled suddenly at me, little cheeks round and firm as summer apples, so I could see what a very lively and attractive girl she must have been.
"He struck me the once," she confided, "and I snatched the girdle off the fire and crowned him wi' it."
She rocked back and forth, laughing.
"Thought I'd killed him for sure, and me wailing and holding of his heed in my lap, thinking what would I do, a widow with 2 bairns to feed. But he came round," she said matter-of-factly, "and ne'er laid a hand on me or the bairnies again." "'I bought 13, you ken,' she said proudly, "'and raised 10.'
"'Congratulations,' I said, meaning it.
"'Raspberry leaves,' she said, laying a confiding hand on my knee. "'Mark me, lassie, raspberry leaves will do it. "'And if not, come to see me, "'and I'll make ye a bitty drink o' cornflour and marrow seed "'wi' a raw egg beaten up in it. "'That'll draw your man's seed straight up into the womb, ye ken, "'and you'll be swelling like a pumpkin by Easter.'
"'I coughed, growing a bit red in the face.
"'Mm-hmm. "'And you want Jamie, his lairdship, I mean, "'to take your grandson into his house as stable lad, "'to get him away from his father?'
"'Aye, that's it. "'Now he's a branky wee wacker, his rabbi, "'and his lairdship will no be—'
"'The old lady's face froze in the midst of her animated conversation. "'I turned to look over my shoulder and froze as well. "'Redcoats, dragoons, six of them on horseback, "'making their way carefully down the hill toward the mill-house.' With admirable presence of mind, Mrs. McNab stood up and sat down again on top of Jamie's discarded clothes, her spreading skirts hiding everything. There was a splash and an explosive gasp from the millpond behind me as Jamie surfaced again. I was afraid to call out or move for fear of attracting the dragoon's attention to the pond, but the sudden silence behind me told me he had seen them. The silence was broken by a single word travelling across the water, softly spoken, but heartfelt in its sincerity.
"Merde," he said.
The old lady and I sat unmoving, stone-faced, watching the soldiers come down the hill. At the last moment, as they made the final turn around the mill-house path, she turned swiftly to me and laid a stick-straight finger across her withered lips. I mustn't speak and let them hear that I was English. I didn't have time even to nod in acknowledgement before the mud-caked hooves came to a halt a few feet away.
"'Good morrow to you, ladies,' said the leader.
He was a corporal, but not, I was pleased to see, Corporal Hawkins. A quick glance showed me that none of the men were among those I had seen at Fort William, and I relaxed my grip on the handle of my basket just a fraction.
"'We saw the mill from above,' the dragoon said, and thought, perhaps, to purchase a sack of meal.
He divided a bow between us, not sure who to address. Mrs. McNab was frosty but polite.
"'Good morrow,' she said, inclining her head. "'But if you've come for meal, I fear me you'll be sair disappointed. The mill wheel's nae working just now. Perhaps next time you come this way.' "'Oh, what's amiss, then?'
The corporal, a short young man with a fresh complexion, seemed interested. He walked down to the edge of the pond to peer at the wheel. The miller, popping up in the mill to report the latest progress with the millstone, saw him and hastily popped back down out of sight. The corporal called to one of his men. Climbing up the slope, he gestured to the other soldier, who obligingly stooped to let the corporal climb on his back. Reaching up, he managed to catch the edge of the roof with both hands and squirmed up onto the thatch. Standing, he could barely reach the edge of the great wheel. He reached out and rocked it with both hands. Bending down, he shouted through the window to the miller to try turning the millstone by hand. I willed myself to keep my eyes away from the bottom of the sluice. I wasn't sufficiently familiar with the workings of water wheels to know for sure, but I was afraid that if the wheel gave way suddenly, anything near the underwater works might be crushed. Apparently this was no idle fear, for Mrs. McNab spoke sharply to one of the soldiers near us.
"'You should call your master Doon now, laddie. He'll do no good to the mill or himself. You shouldn't have meddled with things as you dinna understand.' "'Oh, you've no cause for worry, missus,' said the soldier casually. "'Corporal Silver's father has a wheat mill in Hampshire.' What the corporal doesn't know about water wheels would fit in me shoe.
Mrs. McNab and I exchanged looks of alarm. The corporal, after a bit more clambering up and down and exploratory rockings and pokings, came down to where we sat. He was perspiring freely and wiped his red face with a large, grubby handkerchief before addressing us.
"'I can't move it from above, and that fool of a miller doesn't seem to speak any English at all.'
He glanced at Mrs. McNab's sturdy stick and gnarled limbs, then at me.
Perhaps the young lady could come and talk to him for me.
Mrs. McNab stretched out a protective hand, gripping me by the sleeve.
"You'll hate to pardon my daughter-in-law, sir. She's gone sair saft in the heed ever sin' her last babe were stillborn. Hasna spoke a word in over a year, poor lassie. And I canna leave her for a minute, for fear she'll throw herself into the water in her grief."
I did my best to look soft-headed. No great effort in my present state of mind. The corporal looked disconcerted.
"Oh," he said. "Well?"
He wandered down to the edge of the pond and stood frowning into the water. He looked just as Jamie had an hour before, and apparently for the same reason.
"No help for it, Collins," he said to the old trooper. "I'll have to go under and see what's holding it."
He took off his scarlet coat and began to unfasten the cuffs of his shirt. I exchanged looks of horror with Mrs. McNab. While there might be sufficient air under the mill house for survival, certainly there was not room to hide very effectively. I was considering, not very optimistically, the chances of throwing a convincing epileptic fit when the great wheel suddenly creaked overhead. With a sound like a tree being murdered, the big arc made a swooping half-turn, stuck for a moment, then rolled into a steady revolution, scoops merrily pouring bright streamlets into the sluice. The corporal paused in his undressing, admiring the arc of the wheel.
"Look at that, Collins. Wonder what was stuck in it."
As though in answer, something came into sight at the top of the wheel. It hung from one of the scoops, sodden red folds dripping. The scoop hit the stream, now churning down the sluice. The object came loose, and Jamie's father's erstwhile drawers floated majestically out into the waters of the mill pond. The elderly trooper fished them out with a stick, presenting them gingerly to his commander, who plucked them off the stick like a man obliged to pick up a dead fish. "Hmm," he said, holding up the garment critically.
"Wonder where on earth that came from. Must have been caught around the shaft. Curious that something like that could cause so much trouble, isn't it, Collins?" "Yes, sir."
The trooper plainly didn't consider the interior workings of a Scottish mill wheel to be of absorbing interest, but answered politely. After turning the cloth over a time or two, the corporal shrugged and used it to wipe the dirt from his hands.
"Decent bit of flannel," he said, wringing out the sopping cloth. "It'll do to polish tack, at least. Something of a souvenir, eh, Collins?"
And with a polite bow to Mrs. McNab and me, he turned to his horse. The dragoons had barely disappeared from sight over the brow of the hill when a splashing from the mill pond heralded the rising from the depths of the resident water sprite. He was the bloodless white, blue-tinged, of Carrera marble, and his teeth chattered so hard that I could barely make out his first words, which were, in any case, in Gaelic. Mrs. McNab had no trouble making them out, and her ancient jaw dropped. She snapped it shut, though, and made a low reverence toward the emergent laird. Seeing her, he stopped his progress toward the shore, the water still lapping modestly about his hips. He took a deep breath, clenching his teeth to stop the chattering, and plucked a streamer of duckweed off his shoulder.
"Mrs. McNab," he said, bowing to his elderly tenant.
"Sir," she said, bowing back once again. "A fine day, is it not?"
"A bit brisk," he said, casting an eye at me.
I shrugged helplessly.
"We're pleased to see you back in your home, sir, and it's our hope, the lads and myself, as you'll soon be back to stay."
"Mine too, Mrs. McNab,"
Jamie said courteously. He jerked his head at me, glaring. I smiled blandly. The old lady, ignoring this byplay, folded her gnarled hands in her lap and settled back with dignity.
"Have a wee favour I was wishing to ask of your lairdship," she began, "having to deal with..."
"Granny McNab," Jamie interrupted, advancing a menacing half-step through the water, "whatever your wish is, I'll do it, provided only that you'll give me back my shirt before my parts fall off, we called."
Chapter 29. More Honesty.
In the evenings, when supper was cleared away, we generally sat in the drawing-room with Jenny and Ian, talking companionably of this and that, or listening to Jenny's stories. Tonight, though, it was my turn, and I held Jenny and Ian rapt as I told them about Mrs. McNab and the Redcoats.
"God kens well enough that boys need to be smacked, or he'd no fill them sae fu' o' the deal."
My imitation of Granny McNab brought down the house. Jenny wiped tears of laughter from her eyes. "Lord, that's true enough. And she'd know it, too. What has she got, Ian? 8 boys?" Ian nodded.
"Aye, at least. I can't even remember all their names. Seems like there was always a couple of McNabs about to hunt or fish or swim with when Jamie and I were younger."
"You grew up together?" I asked.
Jamie and Ian exchanged wide, complicitous grins.
"Oh, aye, we're familiar," Jamie said, laughing. "Ian's father was the factor for Lallybroch, like Ian is now. On a number of occasions during my reckless youth, I found myself standing elbow to elbow with Mr. Murray there, explaining to one or other of our respective fathers how appearances can be deceiving, or, failing that, why circumstances alter cases."
"And failing that," said Ian, "I found myself on the same number of occasions bent over a fence rail alongside Mr. Fraser there, listening to him yell his head off while waiting for my own turn."
"Never," replied Jamie indignantly. "I never yelled."
"You call it what you like, Jamie," his friend answered, "but you were awful loud."
"You could hear the both of you for miles," Jenny interjected, "and not only the yelling. You could hear Jamie arguing all the time, right up to the fence." "Aye, you should have been a lawyer, Jamie, but I dinna ken why I always let you do the talking," said Ian, shaking his head. "You always got us in worse trouble than we started."
Jamie began to laugh again.
"You mean the Broch?"
"I do."
Ian turned to me, motioning toward the west, where the ancient stone tower rose from the hill behind the house.
"One of Jamie's better arguments, that was," he said, rolling his eyes upward. "He told Brian it was uncivilized to use physical force in order to make your point of view prevail. Corporal punishment was barbarous," he said, "and old-fashioned to boot. Thrashing someone just because they had committed an act with whose ramifications, that was it, with whose ramifications you didn't agree, was not at all a constructive form of punishment."
All of us were laughing by this time. "Did Brian listen to all of this?" I asked.
"Oh, aye," Ian nodded. "I just stood there with Jamie, nodding whenever he'd stop for breath. When Jamie finally ran out of words, his father sort of coughed a bit and said, 'I see.' Then he turned and looked out of the window for a little, swinging the strap, and nodding his head as though he were thinking. We were standing there, elbow to elbow, like Jamie said, sweating. At last, Brian turned about and told us to follow him to the stables. He gave us each a broom, a brush, and a bucket, and pointed us in the direction of the Broch," said Jamie, taking up the story. "Said I'd convinced him of my point, so he decided on a more constructive form of punishment."
Ian's eyes rolled slowly up, as though following the rough stones of the Broch upward.
"That tower rises 60 feet from the ground," he told me, "and it's 30 feet in diameter, with 3 floors."
He heaved a sigh.
"We swept it from top to the bottom," he said, "and scrubbed it from the bottom to the top. It took 5 days, and I can taste rotted oat straw when I cough, even now." "And you tried to kill me on the 3rd day, said Jamie, "for getting us into that."
He touched his head gingerly.
"I had a wicked gash over my ear where you hit me with a broom."
"Oh, weel," Ian said comfortably. "That was when you broke my nose a 2nd time, so we were even."
"Trust a Murray to keep score," Jamie said, shaking his head.
"Let's see," I said, counting on my fingers. "According to you, Frasers are stubborn, Campbells are sneaky, Mackenzies are charming but sly, and Grahams are stupid. What's the Murray's distinguishing characteristic?"
"You can count on them in a fight," said Jamie and Ian together, then laughed. "You can too," said Jamie, recovering. "You just hope they're on your side."
And both men went off into fits again. Jenny shook her head disapprovingly at spouse and brother. "And we haven't even had any wine yet," she said. She put down her sewing and heaved herself to her feet.
"Come with me, Claire. We'll see has Mrs. Crook made any biscuits to have with the port."
Coming back down the hall a quarter of an hour later with trays of refreshments, I heard Ian say,
"You'll no mind then, Jimmy."
"Mind what?"
"That we wed without your consent, me and Jenny, I mean."
Jenny, walking ahead of me, came to a sudden stop outside the drawing-room door. There was a brief snort from the love-seat where Jamie lay sprawled, feet propped on a hassock.
"Since I didn't tell you where I was, and you had no notion when, if ever, I'd come back, I can hardly blame you for not waiting."
I could see Ian in profile, leaning over the log-basket. His long, good-natured face wore a slight frown.
"Well, I didn't think it right, especially with me being crippled."
There was a louder snort.
"Jenny couldn't have a better husband if he'd lost both legs and your arms as well," Jamie said gruffly.
Ian's pale skin flushed slightly in embarrassment. Jamie coughed and swung his legs down from the hassock, leaning over to pick up a scrap of kindling that had fallen from the basket.
"How did you come to wed anyway, given your scruples?"
he asked, one side of his mouth curling up.
"Gracious man," Ian protested. "You think I had any choice in the matter? Up against a freezer?"
He shook his head, grinning at his friend.
"She came up to me out in the field one day while I was trying to mend a wagon that sprang its wheel. I crawled out all covered with muck, and found her standing there, looking like a bush covered with butterflies. She looks me up and down, and she says..."
He paused and scratched his head.
"Well, I don't know exactly what she said, but it ended with her kissing me, muck notwithstanding, and saying, 'Fine, then, we'll be married on St. Martin's Day.'"
He spread his hands in comic resignation.
"I was still explaining why we couldn't do any such thing, when I found myself in front of a priest saying, 'I take thee, Janet,' and swearing to a lot of very improbable statements."
Jamie rocked back in his seat, laughing.
"Aye, I ken the feeling," he said. "Makes you feel a bit hollow, no?"
Ian smiled, embarrassment forgotten.
"It does, and all. I still get that feeling, you know, when I see Jenny sudden, standing against the sun on the hill, or holding wee Jamie, not looking at me. I see her and I think, 'God, man, she can't be yours, not really.'"
He shook his head, brown hair flopping over his brow.
"And then she turns and smiles at me."
He looked up at his brother-in-law, grinning.
"Well, you know yourself. I can see it's the same with you and your Claire. She's something special, no?"
Jamie nodded. The smile didn't leave his face, but altered somehow.
"Aye," he said softly. "Aye. She is that."
Over the port and biscuits, Jamie and Ian reminisced further about their shared boyhood and their fathers. Ian's father, William, had died just the past spring, leaving Ian to run the estate alone.
"You remember when your father came down on us down by the spring and made us go wi' him to the smithy to see how to fix a wagon tree?" "Aye. And he couldn't understand why we kept squirming and shifting about. And he kept asking you, 'Did you need to go to the privy?'"
Both men were laughing too hard to finish the story, so I looked at Jenny.
"Toads," she said succinctly. "The two of them each had 5 or 6 toads inside his shirt." "Oh, Lord," said Ian. "When the one crawled up your neck and hopped out of your shirt into the forge, I thought I'd die. I cannot imagine why my father didn't wring my neck on several occasions," said Jamie, shaking his head. "It's a wonder I ever grew up."
Ian looked consideringly at his own offspring, industriously engaged in piling wooden blocks on top of each other by the hearth.
"I don't quite know how I'm going to manage it when the time comes I have to beat my own son. I mean, he's so small."
He gestured helplessly at the sturdy little figure, tender neck bent to his task. Jamie eyed his small namesake cynically.
"Aye, he'll be as much a devil as you or I, give him time. After all, I suppose even I must have looked small and innocent at one point."
"You did," said Jenny unexpectedly, coming to set a pewter cup of cider in her husband's hand. She patted her brother on the head.
"You were very sweet as a baby, Jamie. I remember standing over your cot. You can't have been more than two, asleep with your thumb in your mouth, and we'd agreed we'd never seen a prettier lad. You had fat round cheeks and the dearest red curls."
The pretty lad turned an interesting shade of rose and drained his cider at one gulp, avoiding my glance.
"Didn't it last long, though?" Jenny said, flashing white teeth in a mildly malicious smile at her brother. "How old were you when you got your first thrashing, Jamie? 7?
"No, 8, Jamie said, thrusting a new log into the smouldering pile of kindling. "Christ, that hurt. 12 strokes full across the bum, and he didn't let up a bit beginning to end. He never did."
He sat back on his heels, rubbing his nose with the knuckles of one hand. His cheeks were flushed, and his eyes bright from the exertion.
"Once it was over, Father went off a bit and sat down on a rock while I settled myself. Then, when I'd quit howling and got down to a sort of wet snuffle, he called me over to him. Now that I think of it, I can remember just what he said. 'Maybe you can use it on young Jamie, Ian, when the time comes.'"
Jamie closed his eyes, recalling.
"He stood me between his knees and made me look him in the face and said, 'That's the first time, Jamie. I'll have to do it again, maybe 100 times before you're grown to a man.' He laughed a bit then and said, 'My father did it to me at least that often, and you're as stubborn and cockle-headed as ever I was.' He said, 'Sometimes I dare say I'll enjoy thrashing you, depending on what you've done to deserve it. Mostly I won't, but I'll do it nonetheless. So remember it, lad. If your head thinks up mischief, your backside's going to pay for it.' Then he gave me a hug and said, 'You're a braw lad, Jamie. Go away to the house now and let your mother comfort you.' I opened my mouth to say something to that, and he said, quick-like, 'No, I know you don't need it, but she does. Get on with you.' So I came down and Mother fed me bread with jam on it."
Jenny suddenly started to laugh. "I just remembered," she said. "Dad used to tell that story about you, Jamie, about thrashing you and what he said to you. He said, when he sent you back to the house after, you came halfway down, then all of a sudden stopped and waited for him. When he came down to you, you looked up at him and said, 'I just wanted to ask, Father, did ye enjoy it this time?' And when he said, 'No,' you nodded and said, 'Good, I didn't like it much either.'"
We all laughed for a minute together. Then Jenny looked up at her brother, shaking her head. "He loved to tell that story. Dad always said you'd be the death of him, Jamie."
The merriment died out of Jamie's face, and he looked down at the big hands resting on his knees.
"Aye," he said quietly. "Well, I was then, wasn't I?"
Jenny and Ian exchanged glances of dismay, and I looked down at my own lap, not knowing what to say. There was no sound for a moment but the crackling of the fire. Then Jenny, with a quick look at Ian, set down her glass and touched her brother on the knee.
"Jimmy," she said, "it wasn't your fault."
He looked up at her and smiled a little bleakly.
"No, who else's then?"
She took a deep breath and said, "Mine."
"What?"
He stared at her in blank astonishment. She had gone a little paler even than usual, but remained composed. "I said it was my fault, as much as anyone's, for what happened to you, Jamie, and Father." He covered her hand with his own and rubbed it gently.
"Dinna talk daft, lass," he said. "You did what you did to try to deceive me. You're right, if you'd not gone with Randall, he'd likely have killed me here."
She studied her brother's face, a troubled frown wrinkling her rounded brow.
No. I dinna regret taking Randall to the house. Not even if he'd... Well, no. But that wasn't it. She drew a deep breath again, steeling herself. When I took him inside, I brought him up to my room. I didn't ken quite what to expect. I'd not been wi' a man. He seemed very nervous, though, all flushed, and as though he were not certain himself, which seemed strange to me. He pushed me onto the bed, and then he stood there, rubbing himself. I thought at first I'd really damaged him wi' my knee, though I knew I hadn't struck him so hard, really. The colour was creeping up her cheeks, and she stole a sidelong glance at Ian before looking hastily back at her lap. I ken now that he was trying to make himself ready. I didn't mean to let him know I was frightened, so I sat up straight on the bed and stared at him. That seemed to anger him, and he ordered me to turn round. I wouldn't do it, though. I just kept looking at him. Her face was the colour of one of the roses by the doorstep. He unbuttoned himself, and I... Well, I laughed at him.
You did what?
Jamie said incredulously. I laughed. I mean... Her eyes met her brother's with some defiance.
I ken well enough how a man's made. I'd seen you naked enough, and Willie and Ian as well. But he...
A tiny smile appeared on her lips, despite her apparent efforts to suppress it. He looks so funny, all red in the face and rubbing himself so frantic, and yet still only half. There was a choked sound from Ian, and she bit her lip, but went on bravely. He didn't like it when I laughed, and I could see it, so I laughed some more. That's when he lunged at me and tore my dress half off me. I smacked him in the face, and he struck me across the jaw hard enough to make me see stars. Then he grunted a bit, as though that pleased him, and started to climb onto the bed with me. I had just about sense enough left to laugh again. I struggled up onto my knees, and I taunted him. I told him I can't, he was no a real man. I couldn't manage wi' a woman. She bent her head still further, so the dark curls swung down past her flaming cheeks. Her words were very low, almost a whisper. I spread the pieces of my gown apart, and I taunted him wi' my breasts. I told him I knew he was afraid of me because he wasn't a fit to touch a woman, but only to sport wi' beasts and young lads.
Jenny, said Jamie, shaking his head helplessly.
Her head came up to look at him. Well, I did then, she said. That was all I could think of, and I could see that he was fair off his head, but it was plain, too, that he couldn't. And I stared right at his breeches, and I laughed again. And then he got his hands round my throat, throttling me, and I cracked my head against the bedpost, and when I woke, he'd gone. And you, William? There were tears standing in her lovely blue eyes as she grasped Jamie's hands. Jamie, will you forgive me? I know if I'd not angered him that way, he wouldn't have treated you as he did. And then, feyther.
Oh, Jenny, love. Machree, don't.
He was kneeling beside her, pulling her face into his shoulder. Ian, on her other side, looked as though he had been turned to stone. Jamie rocked her gently as she sobbed.
Hush, little dove. You did right, Jenny. It wasn't your fault, and maybe not mine either.
He stroked her back.
Listen, Machree. He came here to do damage under orders, and it would have made no difference who he'd found here, or what you or I might have done. He meant to cause trouble, to rouse the countryside against the English, for his own purposes, and those of the man that hired him.
Jenny stopped crying and sat up, looking at him in amazement. To rouse folk against the English? But why? Jamie made an impatient gesture with one hand.
To find out the folk that might support Prince Charles should it come to another rising.
But I dinna ken yet which side Randall's employer is on.
If he wants to know so that those that follow the prince can be watched and maybe have their property seized,
or if it's that he, Randall's employer, means to go with the prince himself. And what's the Highlands roused and ready for war when the time comes? A din again, and it isn't it important now.
He touched his sister's hair, smoothing it back from her brow.
All that's important is that you're not harmed, and I'm home. Soon I'll come back to stay, Machree. I promise.
She raised his hand to her lips and kissed it, her face glowing. She fumbled in her pocket for a handkerchief and blew her nose. Then she looked at Ian, still frozen by her side, a look of hurt anger in his eyes. She touched him gently on the shoulder. "You think I should have told you?" He didn't move, but went on looking at her.
"Aye," he said quietly, "I do."
She put the handkerchief down in her lap and took him by both hands. "Ian, man, I didn't tell you because I didn't wish to lose you too. My brother was gone, and my father. I didn't mean to lose my own heart's blood as well. For you are dearer to me even than home and family, love." She cast a lopsided smile at Jamie. "And that's saying quite a bit." She looked into Ian's eyes, pleading, and I could see love and hurt pride struggling for mastery on his face. Jamie rose then and touched me on the shoulder. We left the room quietly, leaving them together before the dying fire. It was a clear night, and the moonlight fell in floods through the tall casements. I couldn't fall asleep myself, and I thought perhaps it was the light also that kept Jamie awake. He lay quite still, but I could tell by his breathing that he was not asleep. He turned onto his back, and I heard him chuckle softly under his breath. "What's funny?" I asked quietly. He turned his head toward me.
"Oh, did I wake you, Sassnach? I'm sorry. I was only remembering about things."
I wasn't asleep. I scooted closer. The bed had obviously been made for the days when a whole family slept together on one mattress. The gigantic feather bed must have consumed the entire productivity of hundreds of geese, and navigating through the drifts was like crossing the Alps without a compass. "What were you remembering?" I asked, once I had safely reached his side.
"Oh, about my father, mostly. Things he said."
He folded his arms behind his head, staring musingly at the thick beams that crossed the low ceiling.
"It's strange," he said. "When he was alive, I didn't pay him much heed. But once he was dead, the things he'd told me had a good deal more influence."
He chuckled briefly again.
"What I was thinking about was the last time he thrashed me."
"Funny, was it?" I said. "Anyone ever told you that you have a very peculiar sense of humour, Jamie?" I fumbled through the quilts for his hand, then gave up and pushed them back. He began to stroke my back, and I snuggled next to him, making small noises of pleasure.
"Didn't your uncle beat you then, when you needed it?" he asked curiously.
I smothered a laugh at the thought.
"Lord, no.
He would have been horrified at the thought. Uncle Lamb didn't believe in beating children. He thought they should be reasoned with, like adults." Jamie made a Scottish noise in his throat, indicating derision at this ludicrous idea.
"That accounts for the defects in your character, no doubt," he said, patting my bottom. "Insufficient discipline in your youth."
"What defects in my character?" I demanded. The moonlight was bright enough for me to see his grin.
"You want me to list them all?"
"No." I dug an elbow into his ribs. "Tell me about your father. How old were you then?" I asked.
"Oh, 13, 14 maybe. Tall and skinny with spots. I can't remember why I was being thrashed. At that point it was more often something I'd said than something I'd done. All I remember is we were both of us boiling mad about it. That was one of the times he enjoyed beating me."
He pulled me to him and settled me closer against his shoulder, his arm around me. I stroked his flat belly, toying with his navel.
"Stop that. It tickles. Do you want to hear or no?"
"Oh, I want to hear."
What are we going to do if we ever have children? Reason with them or beat them? My heart raced a little at the thought, though there was no sign that this would ever be more than an academic question. His hand trapped mine, holding it still over his belly.
That's simple. You reason with them, and when you're through, I'll take them out and thrash them.
I thought you liked children.
I do. My father liked me when I wasn't being an idiot, and he loved me too. Enough to beat the daylights out of me when I was being an idiot.
I flopped onto my stomach. All right, then. Tell me about it. Jamie sat up and wadded the pillows more comfortably before lying back down, folded arms behind his head again.
Well, he sent me up to the fence, as usual. He always made me go up first, so I could experience the proper mixture of terror and remorse while I waited for him, he said. But he was so angry, he was right behind me. I was bent over and taking it then, gritting my teeth and determined I'd make no noise about it. Damned if I'd let him know how much it hurt. I was digging my fingers into the wood of the fence rail as hard as I could, hard enough to leave splinters behind, and I could feel my face turning red from holding my breath.
He drew a deep breath, as though making up for it, and let it out slowly.
Usually I'd know when it was going to be over, but this time it didn't stop. It was all I could do to keep my mouth shut. I was grunting with each stroke, and I could feel the tears starting, no matter how much I blinked. But I held on for dear life.
He was uncovered to the waist, almost glowing in the moonlight, frosted with tiny silver hairs. I could see the pulse beat just below his breastbone, a steady throb just under my hand.
I don't know how long it went on, he continued. Not that long, likely, but it seemed like a long time to me. At last he stopped a moment and shouted at me. He was beside himself with fury, and I was so furious myself I could barely make out what he said at first. But then I could. He roared, "Damn you, Jamie, can you no cry out? You're grown now, and I dinna mean to beat you ever again. But I want one good yelp out of you, lad, before I quit, just so I'll think I've made some impression on you at last."
Jamie laughed, disturbing the even movement of his pulse beat.
I was so upset at that, I straightened up and whirled round and yelled at him, "Well, why did you no say so in the first place, you old fool? Ouch!" Next thing I knew, I was on the ground with my ears ringing and a pain in my jaw where he'd clouted me. He was standing over me, panting, and with his hair and his beard all on end. He reached down and got my hand and hauled me up. Then he patted my jaw and said, still breathing hard, "That's for calling your father a fool. It may be true, but it's disrespectful. Come on, we'll wash for supper." And he never struck me again. He still shouted at me, but I shouted back, and it was mostly man to man after that.
He laughed comfortably, and I smiled into the warmth of his shoulder. "I wish I'd known your father," I said. "Well, maybe it's better not," I said, struck by a thought. "He might not have liked you marrying an Englishwoman." Jamie hugged me closer and pulled the quilts up over my bare shoulders.
He'd have thought I'd got some sense at last.
He stroked my hair.
He'd have respected my choice, whoever it was. But you...
He turned his head and kissed my brow gently.
"He would have liked you very much, my Sassenach."
And I recognized it for the accolade it was. Chapter 30. Conversations by the Hearth. Whatever rift Jenny's revelations had caused between her and Ian, it seemed to have healed. We sat for a short time after dinner in the parlour next evening, Ian and Jamie talking over the farm's business in the corner, accompanied by a decanter of elderberry wine, while Jenny relaxed at last with her swollen ankles propped on a hassock. I tried to write down some of the receipts she had tossed over her shoulder at me as we whizzed through the day's work, consulting her for details as I scribbled. "To treat carbuncles," I headed one sheet. "3 iron nails, to be soaked for 1 week in sour ale. Add 1 handful of cedarwood shavings. Allow to set. When shavings have sunk to the bottom, mixture is ready. Apply 3 times daily.